bed. He looked up at me with a totally blank expression. I might as well have been in a burlap sack. I felt humiliated. Still no luck. I went back upstairs, watched some TV, read a little, and then finally fell asleep before Bobby came up from his lair. I used to beat myself up. How could I be the product of such a close, strong marriage, only to find my own faltering after less than 6 months? But comparing my situation to my parents only made me feel worse. At the time, I was too absorbed in my own struggles to figure out why Bobby behaved the way he did. Looking back, I think he too married the person with whom he felt comfortable. He knew I was the kind of woman who would make his worried parents think he had settled down. But I also think he thought if he opened up and I really got to know him, I'd be disappointed, as his parents too often had been. Although I worried about my marriage to Bobby constantly, I kept it mostly to myself. Puddin' had cautioned me that one should never speak poorly of one's spouse, because though I might forgive his transgressions, those who loved me might not. So other than confiding in Lynn and my bridesmaid Judy, who'd been divorced several years earlier, I stayed quiet. Then, late one summer night, Bobby didn't come home, and he wasn't scheduled to be on call. In a panic, I called my cousin Jeff, who came right over. I didn't think Bobby was seeing someone else. I thought he was unconscious in some local hospital or someplace worse. When he finally did come home around 10 the next morning, Bobby said he'd had too much to drink and, not wanting to drive home, had fallen asleep in his car in a parking lot. He vowed to stop drinking. "I'm going to stay on the straight and narrow," he said, "because I love you dearly." I wanted to believe him. Really, I did. My whole life, when I had worked twice as hard as others, I'd achieved my goals. So despite mounting evidence to the contrary, I believed that I could work harder and fix my marriage through sheer force of will and by having a baby. Chapter 4. It's a girl. Conventional wisdom says children never improve shaky relationships. I thought I knew better. I was certain that becoming a family would bring us closer and motivate Bobby to honor his pledge. Plus, at age 28, I was eager to have a child. Time was ticking away, both on my tenure plan and on my biological clock. The first month Bobby and I began trying, I became pregnant, and I was elated. 2 weeks to the day after my period was late, it was Valentine's Day. I squeezed in a doctor's appointment so that she could confirm what I already suspected. That night, I gave Bobby a Valentine with a note that read, "We're going to go from 2 to 3. He reread the note a couple of times before tearing up with joy. That night, we shared the news with his parents and mine, which, like everything else during my first month of pregnancy, was a thrill. Bobby was sober and more attentive to me, but he couldn't keep it up. In less than 2 months, he was back to his erratic, inattentive self. When I was 6 months pregnant, we decided to take a vacation to Egypt, a 2-week cruise along the Nile. We figured it was the last time we'd have an adventurous trip for a long while. Bobby had never traveled much, and I was looking forward to sharing with him a familiar and special place. On our first morning at a hotel outside of Cairo, I woke up at 6 a.m. to find him gone. I looked for him all over the hotel, but he wasn't there. The hotel was across the street from the Great Pyramid and the Sphinx of Giza, so I wandered across the street and walked up the steep hill to the enormous ancient monuments, and there he was, watching the sunrise, alone. "How could you leave me without telling me where you were going?" I asked. "I didn't want to wake you," he shrugged, showing no appreciation for how it might feel to wake up pregnant and alone. For the rest of the trip, it was the same. Despite my pleas, he was always going off exploring for a few hours that turned out to be sometimes late into the night, leaving me to worry on the cruise ship, which was really more of a rickety boat, with engine fumes that made me queasy. Not long after we returned home, I had a serious scare. I started bleeding and it wouldn't stop. My OBGYN, Dr. Jimmy Jones, a close friend of my parents, prescribed a weekend of bed rest. I spent the next 3 days in bed feeling a terrible mix of guilt for taking such a strenuous trip, fierce protectiveness, and desperate powerlessness. Every time I went to the bathroom, I hoped the bleeding had stopped and that my baby was okay. By the morning of day 4, I had stopped bleeding, and thankfully there were no other frightening episodes for the rest of my pregnancy. But that scare gave me a small preview of the love I was about to feel. Throughout my pregnancy, the only way I avoided morning sickness was by eating 5 square meals a day, every day. When the scale tipped to 190 pounds, I refused to look at it anymore. I was done. I'd made it well past full term, and when I was 10 days past due, I'd finally had enough. I packed my bags and went to see Dr. Jones. He suggested we give it another couple days. "No, no," I said. "I'll meet you at the hospital. I'm not going home without a baby." "You really want Pitocin?" he asked, referring to the drug used to induce labor. "It's not very pleasant." It can't be any more unpleasant than carrying around 80 extra pounds on my 110-pound frame. I was admitted to the University of Chicago Medical Center and induced at 11 a.m., whereupon I quickly learned that "not very pleasant" was an astonishing understatement. My labor was excruciating, and it went on and on and on. My mom and Bobby were there, but my dad left town the day before to honor a commitment at a conference, so he kept calling my mom every half an hour to check on my status. As the day went on, my father grew worried enough to call the chairman of the OBGYN department and ask him to check on me. He did, and promptly told my mother he thought I might need a cesarean. Nobody told me, because I had made my feelings on the subject clear. Somehow, I'd adopted a ridiculous notion that my femininity was tied to natural childbirth. I hadn't even attended the Lamaze classes where C-sections were covered. I was determined to give birth naturally, no matter what. In the late afternoon, an anesthesiologist came by to see if I wanted an epidural to blunt some of the pain. Before I could answer, Bobby said, "We aren't having pain medicine." To which I responded, "We aren't having a baby. I am, and yes." Then, around 10 p.m., a first-year resident came in and told me, without much bedside manner, that the baby's heart rate was going down and she needed my consent to attach an internal monitor to her head, something else I had hoped to avoid. Nothing was going according to plan. Another 3 hours went by. Finally, the same resident returned and in a very gentle tone said, "Your baby is in distress. We need to take her." I felt I was completely losing control of the situation. Just then, Dr. Jones appeared. I wondered where he'd been. Little did I know he had been taking a nap to rest up for what he knew was going to be an inevitable surgery. At that point, my stubborn desire to stay in control of my own natural labor was colliding with my heart-wrenching concern for my unborn child's well-being. "Take her," I said. "Where do I sign?" They did an emergency C-section, and at 1:58 a.m. on October 29th, 1985, and in the single most extraordinary moment of my life, the doctor laid my newborn, brown-skinned baby on my chest, and as my arms reflexively folded around her, he announced, "It's a girl." I'd wanted a girl desperately, and I was granted my wish, a healthy, beautiful baby girl, 8 pounds, 11 ounces. We named her Laura after both my grandmother and Bobby's. It was a glorious celebration. I had 21 visitors the first day, and I wound up staying in the hospital for one whole week. Those were the days. I loved pushing that call button, "Ginger ale, please. Please bring me my baby." And, "Take her away, please." The Demerol shots they gave me for the pain that first day made me euphoric. At times, I could barely focus, though I was attentive enough to catch one error on Laura's birth certificate. Having looked only at me, the administrator had mistakenly written that her race was white, just as my mother's birth certificate had. At the end of my stay, I pleaded with Dr. Jones for one more day. I was petrified of leaving. Were they really going to give us this tiny human to take home by ourselves when we had no idea what we were doing? I'd never even changed a diaper before. As Bobby and I struggled to put Laura into her car seat properly, I turned to him and said, "They shouldn't let us have her. This is malpractice." For the next 3 months, I took care of Laura by myself with regular assists from my parents and my grandmother. Then, in the last month of my four-month leave, after interviewing one woman who told me Laura had been reincarnated and another who snatched Laura from me and kissed her on the mouth, I hired Alma Brown to be Laura's caregiver. I knew the first time I heard her calm, friendly voice on the phone that she would be perfect. The sleepless days and nights, the constant new discoveries about looking after this tiny creature, the struggle breastfeeding, would Laura starve if I didn't produce enough milk, and the sleep deprivation. It was all hard. At least, I thought it was hard. Then, at the end of 4.5 months, I went back to work, and that's when I finally learned what the meaning of hard really was. The year before Laura was born, I'd switched to a new, more prestigious firm, Sun and Shine, Carlin, Nath, and Rosenthal. It had the best real estate practice in the city, and I felt by going there I was taking the next great step in a family tradition started by my famous real estate developer grandfather and my pioneering architect great-grandfather. But the allure of real estate quickly evaporated as I was consumed with drafting loan agreements for the construction of office buildings, shopping centers, and hotels. Yawn. Again. I spent endless days negotiating with developers over casualty clauses and insurance and force majeure language. I couldn't believe I'd gone through the ordeal of law school for a practice as tedious and boring as this. I found myself much more interested in looking over the architectural designs and the financing structures that made these deals possible rather than drafting the loan documents I was supposed to be drafting. Not surprisingly, I was fairly unimpressive at my job. I'd been dreading my first day back at work, and it was agony, mentally and physically. During a long meeting, I wanted so badly to excuse myself to pump my breasts, but I was trying to show everyone that all was back to normal. I did my best to ignore the pain and discomfort. Then I looked down and I saw the big wet spots of leaking milk on my blouse. Like countless other working mothers, I wondered, what am I doing? Why did I leave that precious angel at home to be here doing this? The 1980s, for all the badass we can have it all slogans, were not an easy time to be a woman in the workplace. My firm had a four-month paid maternity leave, due in no small part to the female partners with children who had advocated for the change. They also let me take an extra 2 weeks without pay. By the standards of the era, that was considered very generous. Many firms had no set maternity leave beyond sick day policies. Needless to say, no paternity leave at all for men. Only 25% of my classmates in law school were women. The number who went on to be associates at major firms was even lower, and the number who made partner lower still. It was a boys' club, and the other women and I were left to try mightily to fit in, pretending to ourselves and to each other that we could be just like one of the guys. At holiday parties that I attended, given by law firms around the city, I swallowed hard and tried to look the other way when women were harassed, and I ducked out early to avoid falling prey myself. When I was pregnant, I tried to pretend that I wasn't. One late night, 8.5 months along, in full beach whale mode, I was working with several lawyers to close a deal that stretched past 1 in the morning. I kept excusing myself from the conference room to go to the Xerox machine or go back to my office to pick up some more documents or go buy a snack from the vending machine. What I was really doing was going to pee. But why couldn't I just say that? Because I was so busy trying to act like nothing was going on with my body below my head. As soon as I became a working mother, my focus shifted. No longer just a hard-working lawyer, but a superhuman earth mother as well. After working all day and well into the evening, I stayed up to all hours making homemade baby food. It was impossible to keep all of the balls in the air, and I had more than most working moms going in my favor. very supportive parents nearby, a professional degree. I could afford the highest quality childcare. Yet, here I was holding on by my fingertips. I couldn't imagine how much harder it must be for poor and working class families trying to provide and be good parents. The only advantage I didn't have was an equal partner in parenting at home. There were times when Bobby tried to lend a hand, but watching him change a diaper or warm up a bottle exasperated me so much that I would just do it myself. I have to admit, I took a certain pleasure in being better than him at taking care of Laura, but of course, that was totally self-defeating, as it increased my workload while lessening Bobby's responsibilities and his confidence. A perverse sense of pride drove me to want to do everything myself. Meanwhile, back at the office, being one of the guys meant pretending that the demands of motherhood simply didn't exist so I could convince everyone that I was as dedicated and undistracted as the men around me. When I had to take Laura to a pediatrician, instead of being upfront about it, I'd evasively say I had to be out of the office for a while. I thought that success meant competing with men on an uneven playing field while continuing to excel in the traditional roles of a wife and mother. I was setting impossibly high standards for myself, and looking back now, it shouldn't have been surprising that I was constantly falling short and disappointed with myself. Exhausted and aching from my baby, I used to sit at my desk with a file in my hand and say to myself, "You have to focus." But I couldn't bring myself to speak up. I couldn't bring myself to go to the partners, even those who were women, and point out all of the ways the politics of the boys' club were unfair. And my pride wouldn't let me confide in anyone, even to my close friends, most of whom were professional women themselves, and I now suspect they were equally reluctant to confide in me. My silence stemmed mostly from my shame and feeling alone, as though I was the only overwhelmed working mother. I told myself that if I was just smarter, more organized, and more efficient, if I just tried harder and slept less, perhaps it all wouldn't be so hard. As women of my generation fought to gain equity in the workplace, we made an unspoken pact to pretend, even to one another, that we had it all under control. We didn't. We couldn't possibly. Instead of improving after Laura was born, my marriage only deteriorated. I hadn't anticipated how little patience I would have for trying to take care of Bobby once I had an actual baby. My entire orientation pivoted away from him and towards Laura. I completely lost interest in working on our marriage. In the evenings, I went to my corner of our tiny apartment with Laura, and he went to his alone. I didn't see myself getting divorced, so I just assumed this was my new depressing status quo. It was the life I had chosen and the life with which I was stuck. Then, on the third Friday of March, only a month after I'd returned to work, Bobby called me with startling news. A few months earlier, Bobby had been cut from his surgical residency and had applied for the match, where residents and hospitals rank each other and then hopefully are paired up. Bobby had ranked surgical gynecology programs in Chicago, but he hadn't matched anywhere. None of the area hospitals had selected him. My father had offered to find him a place at a Chicago pathology department, but Bobby didn't want to do that. He only wanted surgery. After hearing the news, I told him I would rush right home so we could talk. When I arrived, he told me, the only place I could find a residency in surgery is Pontiac, Michigan. When I said we'd have to discuss it, he confessed that he'd already accepted the position. He said he was afraid he would lose it. But I'm sure he also feared that I would try to talk him out of accepting it. I was furious. A decision to move out of state so soon after having a child should have been made together. He went to his corner, and I went to mine, and that was it. Bobby didn't ask me to come with him, and I didn't offer. My moving didn't make practical sense on any level. I made twice as much money as he did. Moving would also mean starting all over, taking the Michigan bar, and finding a new job. not to mention losing the support structure of my family and Mrs. Brown, upon whom I relied to help me take care of Laura during my 10-hour workdays. I just couldn't believe that Laura and I weren't enough to keep him in Chicago. But I wasn't about to ask him not to go, because I didn't want him to resent me for standing in the way of his professional dreams. The Michigan residency started in 4 months, and the closer it came to the time of his departure, the more terrified I was about what it would mean for me and for us. Living alone in Chicago as a single mom certainly was not what I had imagined when I tried to save our marriage by having a child. Then, as we expected, one early July morning, Bobby packed his belongings, kissed Laura goodbye while she slept in her crib, and walked out of the front door. I had no idea how I was going to manage a baby by myself, or what was in store for me next, because none of this was a part of my 10-year plan. Looking back on those years when I was a young working mom, I wish I hadn't defined success as achieving the mighty juggle with flawless perfection. I wish I had not felt it would make me appear weak or vulnerable to admit to myself, as well as more openly to others, when I was struggling and needed help. I wish I'd known that Laura would have been just fine with baby food from a jar. I wish that I had embraced the thrill of the zig and zag rather than crave straight lines. I wish that I had understood that hard work does not always prevent failures, and that my failures do not define me. In fact, missteps often teach valuable lessons and provide the resilience to bounce back stronger. Chapter 5. The Quiet Voice. By the time I turned 30, my marriage was on life support. Bobby had been in Michigan for over a year. It was hard in the beginning, but I slowly began to realize how my life had actually improved with him out of the picture. I was relieved to no longer be juggling his wants and needs with those of my daily life. I started to appreciate how lonely I'd been when he was there, but not there, coming home late and hiding behind his headphones and records in the basement. It was a loneliness far more painful than I ever experienced when I was single. Once he left, we didn't communicate or see each other much. He was busy and I was busy. At least that was the excuse we both used to avoid each other. I can count on one hand the number of times he came home during that first year, and I was no more eager to visit him in Michigan. I went only twice. I began to dread our visits. For my 30th birthday, Bobby used his residency schedule as an excuse not to come home. Since I didn't want to go out and leave Laura with a sitter, and I was in no mood to celebrate, I invited three of my close childhood girlfriends to come over and to spend the evening with me. In lieu of showing up, Bobby had sent an arrangement of bright primary color carnations in the shape of a small triangular tree. Stunningly ugly. I plopped it in the middle of the dining room table, and the four of us just sat there, inhaling my favorite cheesecake and downing homemade daiquiris, staring at the floral monstrosity. At first, no one wanted to comment, but after a few drinks, I couldn't hold back. What is the message he is sending me with flowers that look like that? Nobody answered, but we all knew. Finally, a little after 8 p.m., I called it. "Just go home," I said. "Party's over. I'm going to bed." They were relieved. So was I. My daughter once said to me that my marriage was the best mistake I ever made. I know what she meant, but I would put it differently. In my wrong-headed, last-ditch attempt to save my marriage, the very best decision I ever made was having my daughter. The moment Laura came into this world, she made me want to be a stronger person. She made me realize I had to be a stronger person. I'd been caught up in an immature daydream, and marrying Bobby had only given me a false sense of fulfillment and security. When he left for Michigan, I was a new mom, terrified and miserable, and with him gone, I feared life would only get worse. Instead, the opposite happened. Every day without Bobby there, I became more self-assured, more confident. For the first time, I enjoyed being on my own, pouring all of my love and attention into this little person who was completely reliant on me. I'd look down at Laura asleep in my arms, and I'd say to myself, this little girl is counting on me to take care of her, so I better stop waiting on somebody else to take care of me. Knowing that my daughter was depending on me was enough to propel me out of bed, trudge downtown, and stick it out at work. But I knew I couldn't last at that law firm much longer. All I was doing was helping wealthy clients mitigate risks so they could become even wealthier. It left me feeling empty, without purpose. Being an associate at a high-powered corporate firm, I felt constant, enormous pressure to produce clients. Yet, I didn't really have any prospects, and I was utterly uninterested in cultivating any. A partner with whom I regularly worked gave me the ultimate backhanded compliment one day. Valerie, he said, you'd make a much better partner than you do associate. I understood what he meant. I wasn't good at my job. But I didn't need him to tell me that. I knew it already. Early on, I thought the sacrifices would be worth it when I became a partner. But by my sixth year out of law school, I realized that the life of the partners didn't seem much better either. On the 79th floor of the Sears Tower, I had the world literally at my feet. But I was at my lowest ebb. My career had hit a wall, and my marriage was falling apart. Except for Laura, my 10-year plan felt like a 10-year disaster. I used to close my office door and spend hours lost in my own thoughts, often in tears, staring east out over the calming, peaceful waters of Lake Michigan. I wished they could transport me someplace, any place else. This simply could not be my life. I wanted and expected so much more. But I knew that just looking out over the water wasn't going to take me anywhere. What I didn't realize at the time, and what I would come to understand only with the help of a good friend, was that the path I needed to take was right there in front of me, outside my office window. All I had to do was shift my gaze a few blocks northeast to City Hall. When Harold Washington was elected Chicago's first black mayor in 1983, it sent a shockwave throughout the entire city. He was a beloved figure among the black, Latino, and liberal lakefront constituencies. He had a big, roaring laugh, a twinkle in his eye, and a personality so warm and charismatic that even people who didn't want to like him couldn't help but be charmed. He was a captivating speaker, too, always dropping 4- and 5-syllable words in new and creative ways. Still, no one thought he would actually win. That was true for black voters and white voters, for political insiders and everyday folks as well. Chicago, with its history, we all believed, was not ready for a black mayor. But to everyone's surprise, Washington wound up winning the 3-way Democratic primary after the other two candidates, then Mayor Jane Byrne and Richard M. Daley, son of the late Mayor Richard J. Daley, split the white vote. The racism of Washington's opponents rose to the surface quickly, however, when he faced Republican Bernie Epton in the general election. People circulated pamphlets with pictures of chicken bones and watermelon. The Republican candidate's campaign slogan was, "Before it's too late." One of the ugliest moments came when Washington went to stump with Vice President Walter Mondale at a Catholic church in the city's white Northwest Side. He was met by an angry mob shouting, "Blacks, go home," and the church door had been defaced with the spray-painted words, "Nigger die." But Chicago turned out to be more democratic than it was racist, and on April 12, 1983, Washington was elected mayor. Walking the 4 blocks to my office the next morning, wearing my Herald for Mayor button on my jacket, I felt an enormous sense of pride, not just because he was black, but also because he was both the underdog and a reformer whose message of inclusion and opportunity for all resonated profoundly with me. But even in the short walk, I could see a deep divide in the reactions my button provoked. All the black people nodded and smiled and winked. Some of the white folks did too, but many just looked away. When I arrived at my law firm, people were more stunned than celebratory. Nobody said a word about it. I lived on the south side, and nearly everybody else in my office lived to the north. So I used to joke that when we left work, I turned right and they all turned left. That statement never felt more true than on that morning. Once he was in office, however, Harold Washington's energy and enthusiasm for a progressive agenda proved to be contagious. He loved to stop to chat and laugh with anyone and everyone, even the aldermen actively trying to thwart his agenda. He would go on to prove in Chicago, just like black mayors were in Los Angeles, Atlanta, Detroit, and Philadelphia, that black politicians are capable of being leaders for all citizens, regardless of color, which is why he won re-election by a solid margin 4 years later in 1987. I had volunteered on his campaign, knocking on doors on election day to turn out the vote. I was spellbound during his second inaugural speech, which extolled the power of the city's diversity. Chicago, he said, has brought together black and white, Asian and Hispanic, male and female, the young, the old, the disabled, gays and lesbians, Muslims, Christians and Jews, business leaders and neighborhood activists, bankers and trade unionists, all have come together to mix and contend, to argue and to reason, to confront our problems and not merely to contain them. We didn't come together out of love for one another. Where that is lacking, that will follow. A civil society, a civilization, a city that works, requires simply that we behave well towards each other. Those words certainly still ring true to me today. Mayor Washington had big ideals and a grand vision of humanity, a vision I wouldn't see realized on a much larger scale until 25 years later on election night 2008, when people of all kinds and all races gathered in Grant Park to celebrate Barack Obama's victory. As President Obama himself has often said, had there not been a Mayor Washington, there may not have been a President Obama. When Washington was first elected, several of Chicago's top black lawyers left private practice to work for his administration. I knew that because I knew all of them. Then, as now, there weren't many black lawyers at large corporate firms in Chicago, and we all banded together, just like the black kids sitting together in the cafeteria at the lab schools or in the Ujamaa dorm at Stanford. It was a way to commiserate about our shared dilemmas. It was also a network for younger associates like me to reach out to more experienced lawyers for advice and support. Elvin Charity was one of those lawyers for me. A graduate of Yale College and Harvard Law, Elvin had already made partner at the firm of Hopkins & Sutter, and he'd taken a 2-year leave of absence to serve as chief assistant corporation counsel for real estate in Mayor Washington's first administration. My uncle Lester had introduced me to Elvin and his wife Roxanne when they first moved to Chicago in 1981. He had become a close friend, a great mentor, and he was a brilliant attorney. Elvin also had an eye for talent. A few years later, in 1989, he hired Harvard Law School student Barack Obama as a summer associate. I desperately needed advice, so I invited Elvin to lunch in the restaurant in the lobby of the Sears Tower. Whispering out of earshot of any colleagues from my firm who might have been nearby, I said, "I can't figure out what to do. I'm already on my second law firm, and I can't just keep switching from one to another. That's not going to solve my problem." "What about joining Harold Washington's administration and practicing law there?" he said. Elvin's 2-year leave of absence from Hopkins and Sutter was winding up, and he was leaving the administration himself. But, he said, it was an exciting time to be in City Hall. Unlike in his first term, Washington now controlled a majority on the city council, and he finally had the power to make some of his progressive initiatives happen. I told Elvin I wasn't sure. It wasn't a path I'd ever considered for myself. Working in local government would be a major pivot in my 10-year plan. But I drew courage from my dad, whose own circuitous path through Iran and Great Britain to his dream job in Chicago always demonstrated to me the importance of being flexible and willing to pivot. When I was growing up, and even after I moved back to the city, I didn't know much about how city government worked. I didn't know my alderman's name, let alone the size and scope of the city's budget, or how the garbage got picked up, or the labor contracts and the negotiations that went on to make that happen. What I did know was that if it snowed and the mayor didn't make sure it was picked up in all parts of the city, he could lose an election. That's what had happened to Mayor Bolandic in 1979 when Chicago had one of its worst snowstorms, and the mayor directed the crews to prioritize cleaning the streets on the north side, but not the south side. The swift reaction was to elect Jane Byrne mayor. I was pretty clueless about everything else. My first and only involvement had come 2 years earlier when a partner at my firm had nominated me to participate in a Leadership Greater Chicago program, which opened my eyes for the first time to the workings of city government and the broader civic life of our city. The blinders that had kept me focused on one straight career path began to fade. In the program, I met young leaders from around the city, all engaged in different but seemingly rewarding careers. Elvin insisted. "You should do it," he said. "In City Hall, you'll go to work every day feeling a part of the common purpose you felt on Election Day. You'll belong to a movement larger and more important than yourself. You'll never regret it, I promise you. Worst comes to worst, you can always go back to a law firm." And so, against the advice of many, including my parents, who saw a job in City Hall as a step down from my corporate one, I decided to explore a move into the public sector. It took a big leap of faith, so I began with someone I trusted. I reached out to a childhood friend, Allison Davis, who arranged for me to meet his former partner, Judd Minor. In 1971, the two of them had founded Davis, Minor, Barnhill, and Gallon, a boutique civil rights law firm with two major claims to fame. It argued a number of important civil rights cases before the U.S. Supreme Court and hired Barack Obama as a young lawyer in 1993. Judd, like Elvin, had left his firm to join the administration as corporation counsel for the city. I interviewed with Judd, and he then passed me on to his deputy, David Narewski. In August of 1987, David offered me a job working for him in the council's office in City Hall as the director of collateral land. It was an awkward manufactured title, but what it meant was that I had the legal responsibility for managing the redevelopment of large tracts of vacant, city-owned land, specifically around O'Hare International Airport. The mayor wanted it to become a revenue-generating commercial property compatible with the airport. The work was the opposite of sexy. When I described it to my friends, their eyes would glaze over. The pay was less, much less, and I traded my private 79th floor office with an unobstructed view of Lake Michigan for a fifth floor cubicle with a dirty window looking out on an alley. After giving me a ride to City Hall on a sticky August morning for my first day of work, my mom said, "After all that college and law school tuition, I can't believe I'm dropping you off at this place." I didn't care what anyone else thought. From day one, I loved it, and I knew this was where I belonged. And the timing was perfect. Elvin had been right about the sea change in the city council, which now had a majority of the aldermen supporting the mayor's agenda to make the city fairer and inclusive, including creating city contracts and job opportunities for people of color and women. Under previous administrations, the government's focus had been predominantly on the city's central business district. Mayor Washington wanted to also invest resources in the neighborhoods, and the budget he proposed reflected his priorities: investment in public schools, job creation and training programs, the park system, and neighborhood infrastructure. I wasn't the only former corporate lawyer who'd come to work for Mayor Washington and to be a part of the change he promised. Judd and his predecessor Jim Montgomery, who later practiced with Johnny Cochran, had recruited lawyers from the highest caliber law firms to bring in new skills to help implement the mayor's progressive agenda. I felt an instant kinship not just with the lawyers, but with all the men and women working at City Hall. I walked into the office every day giddy with excitement. The people I'd spent years reading about in the newspapers, such as the aldermen and the mayor's top deputies, Whenever I passed them in the hall, it felt like a celebrity sighting. The first time I was in a meeting chaired by the mayor's deputy chief of staff, all I could think was, I can't believe I'm in a meeting with Brenda Gaines. That was doubly true for Mayor Washington himself. I always took every opportunity I could to hear him speak or just be in his presence, except for once, and I will always regret it. In November of 1987, 2 nights before Thanksgiving, I was leaving work late, around 8 o'clock, anxious as always to get home to Laura. I'd been at City Hall for just 3 months at that point. As I walked out of the law department, I could hear Mayor Washington's booming voice coming from his office suite down the hall. It had a cavernous front lobby where receptions were often held, and the mayor was giving a speech to one of the many constituency groups he hosted there several nights a month. Hearing his voice, I thought, I should stay and listen. But then I thought better of it. I'm so tired, and I miss Laura. I can hear him any time. And I left. The very next morning, shortly after 11 a.m., I was working at my desk when one of his assistants ran in and said, "The mayor has collapsed." Her brother, a policeman stationed on the first floor, had called to tell her that, and that emergency responders were trying to resuscitate him. We all rushed out to the lobby of the law department, where a glass door separated us from the hallway right next to the mayor's private office. After several minutes, his door swung open, and there he was, lying on a gurney, his face a deep purple, as the swift-moving EMTs rushed him out of sight. But it was too late. At 1:36 p.m. that afternoon, Mayor Washington was pronounced dead of a massive heart attack. Mayor Washington's tragic death pulled the city apart in profound ways. There was grief and anger, and in the inevitable political power struggle that followed, the city's racist politics crept back into play. After a protracted and divisive city council meeting that lasted until 4 a.m., the alderman-elected fellow Alderman Eugene Sawyer, Jr., mayor. Everyone who'd come to City Hall to join Mayor Washington was worried that his progressive agenda would erode under Sawyer's old-school politics. The fact that he was a consensus choice made many of us worry about the expectations of the white alderman who'd supported him. But in the end, Judd Minor and my primary client, Lucille Dobbins, assistant to the mayor for finance administration, elected to stay. So I did too. During my time at City Hall, Lucille became my first professional role model of a powerful, confident black woman. Married to a kind and supportive man, fiercely devoted to her teenage daughter, Lucille was still an indefatigable workaholic. She worked all of the time. She was tough as nails, but took good care of those she thought deserved her support. I was lucky enough to have her take me under her wing. Prior to her current position, Lucille had been deputy commissioner in the Department of Planning, where she oversaw the financial planning of the redevelopment of the North and South Loop. Now, from the mayor's office, she was handling oversight for all city finance developments, including my project at O'Hare. With the help of Elvin Charity as outside counsel, Lucille and I began an open process for packaging the land by the airport and putting it out to bid for private developers. Once that project was underway, Lucille began to bring me into other municipal finance and development initiatives outside the original scope of my work. In large-scale, city-backed real estate developments, financing structures are always extremely complicated because layers of government subsidies are required in order to make the project feasible. Conventional private financing alone isn't sufficient. So the city steps in, often with state and federal government partners as well, and uses its public resources to achieve various public purposes. It lures private developers with subsidized prices in order to revitalize communities and return property to the tax rolls, or offers manufacturers financial incentives to modernize old buildings, to expand and keep jobs in the city. Lucille and I also tackled complex workouts for several publicly funded projects, such as the Chicago Theater on State Street, a landmark theater in the heart of downtown. The legal work I specialized in before coming to City Hall is known as papering a deal. After a client makes a business deal with the help of its in-house legal team, outside counsel is brought in and is given the term sheet, which counsel then translates into a legal document. Their job is to scour the details for any possible risk the client could face, from earthquakes to bankruptcy. It's complicated and tedious, but necessary. The work I did for the city was similar in form, but not in substance. Yes, I was still papering deals for less money and in a worse office, but the projects themselves were meaningful to me. I cared about the mission of helping to revitalize the city, and the chance to work with incredibly talented public servants gave me a purpose and satisfaction I'd never felt before. On every deal, we always ask the same question: will the citizens of Chicago be better off if we do this? Every time we use taxpayer dollars to acquire or finance the redevelopment of a property, we reminded ourselves that the funds came from the public's pocket, so the investment better be worth it. And importantly, Lucille valued more than just my legal opinion. Now that I was in-house counsel for the city, with no timesheets for me to fill out or bills for her to pay for my time, she made sure that I was included in the whole process, from the initial policy discussions before a deal was structured all the way through the ribbon cutting of a finished project. She knew I cared as much about the policy as I did about the law. That enabled me to make a dramatic leap professionally and personally. Too often, we can tread water for so long in our own misery that it becomes the new normal. As a young woman, and even after I married, when I was unhappy, I hesitated to speak up. I avoided risks and rocking the boat. I felt like I was leading someone else's life, deferring to the choir of voices around me rather than heeding the quiet one deep within. I clung to my plan, which, as it turned out, had really been my way of satisfying everyone else. But when Bobby and I separated and my corporate career bottomed out, my plan completely fell apart, forcing me to reflect on where I was in my life and whether the future I'd fantasized about made sense any longer. My unhappiness motivated my pivot, but it was also a choice. I learned not only how to trust my own voice and act on what it was telling me, but also how to use my voice to advocate for change and progress for the city that I loved. A few years later, on one project in particular, the city's effort to lure a major airline to open a 500-person reservation center in the city, I went toe-to-toe with the commissioner, who was the point person on the deal. He was ready to concede to whatever the airline wanted. I was determined to lock in all the terms of the deal up front, as corporations have a checkered history of taking subsidies from cities and then not making good on their promises. So I pulled an all-nighter with the senior partner from the law firm representing the airline. Only after a grueling marathon negotiation was I comfortable that the city's interests were protected, including a long-term commitment to create jobs. I went over the commissioner's head and sealed a better deal for the city. One reason I had originally picked commercial law over litigation was because litigation would have required me to stand on my feet and speak in front of an audience. It was also because I don't like there being winners and losers. However, when winning wasn't about personal advancement, but rather about being a force for good, I found the confidence to give voice to my opinions and ideas. My clients were now really the citizens of Chicago, and I was emboldened to push back on their behalf when I disagreed with policymakers inside government or folks on the outside trying to take advantage. I started to make trouble. I started to make waves. My dad put it best when he saw my transformation. "What happened to my shrinking Violet?" he said, clearly proud of how far I'd come. "She's gone," I said, with a confident smile. Understanding the strength of my voice also meant learning to modulate it. I had noticed that when Lucille pushed hard, it made men uncomfortable. It isn't fair that men are given latitude to lose their temper without repercussions while women are not, but if women waited for every double standard to disappear before moving forward, we'd still be waiting on the right to vote. So I learned to employ my mother's technique of being firm and clear without ever raising my voice. It's a strategy that I use to this day in both my professional and personal lives. Lucille, shall we say, used a different tack. As a champion of the city, she prided herself on being tough because her cause was just. "I'm the steward for the taxpayers of Chicago," she would say, "and if people are not stepping up as high as they should, well, then we'll make them." She held everyone accountable, no matter how wealthy or powerful. I watched the powerful wither in the face of her criticism, and I was always comfortable being the good cop and she the bad one, roles we often played in meetings. Toward me, however, Lucille never used a sharp word. She set high expectations, and I was determined to meet them. I never wanted to disappoint her, not because I feared her, but because she invested in me, taught and protected me, and in return, I wanted her approval. Still, keeping pace with her was grueling. Laura would cry and beg me to come home at night in time to tuck her in, and I felt horrible every time I couldn't make it, which began to be too often. No job, no matter how gratifying, was more important than Laura. I had been hesitant to broach the subject of leaving work early, by which I mean at a normal, reasonable time. I knew the stigma applied to working moms who weren't fully committed, a nebulous standard often applied arbitrarily to hold women back. But one day, I worked up the courage to raise the issue of my work hours with Lucille. Casually, during our regular morning meeting, I said, "I need to figure out how to make it home before Laura's bedtime, but of course I'll work from home as long as necessary afterwards." Gulp. I thought she might lay into me. Instead, she smiled, no doubt remembering her own challenges as a working mom when her daughter was young, and said, "Well, your home is on my way home. How about if we move our offices to your home when we need to work late?" So we did. I even began cooking dinner for Lucille and myself and sometimes for Elvin, who was our outside counsel. I would tuck Laura in bed and then we'd work late together. It was unorthodox, but she understood my circumstances and was willing to work around my schedule as a single mom. She knew that I would be the most productive if I were able to fulfill my responsibilities to Laura, which was a valuable lesson for me when I became a manager myself. To be honest, I've lost count of all the ways Lucille mentored and helped me. Without her, it's unlikely my career would have taken the sharp trajectory upwards that it did. One day, after David Noreski announced he was leaving city government, Lucille and I were working with Elvin in a conference room at his firm. Lucille, out of nowhere, said to me, "Your boss should report to you." She was referring to my immediate supervisor, who was between David and me. "That's ridiculous," I said. "No, what's ridiculous is you thinking a promotion is going to just fall in your lap without you pushing for it," she said. "You should go and tell Judd, that is, my boss's boss's boss, that I am your client, and I am telling you that you've earned it." Elvin piped up that I certainly deserved a promotion, but he doubted Judd would leapfrog me over my boss. I agreed. I couldn't imagine asking for a promotion, let alone two. I naively assumed that when Judd thought I deserved it, he would promote me. It never occurred to me to ask, and I was content where I was. Despite my protests, over the next several weeks, Lucille raised the issue every single day. All the strong-arming she usually employed against the people on the opposite side of the negotiating table, she now brought to bear on me. So much so that I began to dread seeing her. Her tone became increasingly irritable, and I could sense that she was growing disappointed in my lack of motivation and courage. "What's the worst that could happen?" she argued. "He tells you no, and you stay where you are." Finally, I relented and worked up the nerve to make an appointment to see John. I walked into his office and sat down. Too nervous for any small talk, I launched right in. "So," I said, "I think I've earned a promotion." Judd didn't respond, so I just kept talking, reading from the little crib sheet in my trembling hands where I'd written down all the reasons why I had earned it. Judd listened silently as I rattled on for what felt like an hour, but was probably only a few minutes. At the end of my speech, he nodded and said, "All right." I was shocked he'd said yes so quickly. Giddy from my adrenaline high, I immediately followed up by asking if I could move into a vacancy in the three-office suite where he was, rather than one of the deputy offices buried in the bowels of the building. Judd, laughing at my nerve, said no. I pointed out that having a woman of color prominently located next to him would show his commitment to diversity. That didn't do it either. Finally, I said, "How about I just move in until you figure out who else you want in the office?" He hesitated for a moment, and I jumped right in with, "Thanks, Judd," and I flew out of his office. I couldn't wait to tell Lucille. She just smiled. Looking back years later, it seemed a little too easy. And why wasn't Judd surprised? I'm now sure Lucille must have already made her feelings clear to Judd before I asked. She wasn't just my mentor, but my advocate as well. After my promotion, I pushed my colleague Susan Curlin to go ask Judd for a promotion too. I wanted to do for Susan what Lucille had done for me. Susan had begun in the contracts division, but was also overqualified for her position because of her years in private practice. And of course, it would be more fun for me if she were running the other side of the commercial division of the office. "Go," I told her, "ask for yours." "No, no, I can't," she said. That sounded familiar. "If I did it, you can too." Judd knew Susan and I were buddies, so he was probably expecting her to, and thankfully he said yes to Susan, and she took over supervision of the aviation and contracts practices. I always share this story with working women because just like Susan and me, they all too often shy away from asking for promotions or raises. They don't listen to the quiet voice inside telling them that they have earned it. But I say go for it because you never know. Even if the answer is no, and it often may be, so what? Ask why, work to improve, wait 6 months, and ask again. If I hadn't asked for it, I might still be in my cubicle in City Hall. And if I hadn't learned to trust my voice at work, I might not have found the courage to speak up for myself at home either. Bobby actually managed to make it home for my 31st birthday. But by that point, we had drifted even further apart, absorbed by our separate lives. We had a deep conversation that night, the kind I'd longed to have had years earlier, about the fears of rejection that kept him so aloof, but I knew it was too late to save our marriage. I had enough self-preservation in me to know that trying to hold on would squeeze the life out of me. He was no longer my life. I had my own. Still, I made him a proposition. We could go back to square one, start dating again, and this time really try to communicate. The sage advice given to me by my twice-married Uncle Bill the week before my wedding that I had not followed. "We'd see what happens, but I just can't pick up where we are now." "I don't want to date you," he said. "You're my wife." "Well, then that's that," I said, frankly relieved. He walked towards the door. Laura, now too, was asleep. This time, he didn't stop in her room and kiss her goodbye. Instead, he hurried out quickly so that neither of us would have to face the emotion brimming in the other. As he started for the door, I impulsively said, "Could you leave your key?" I didn't want to endure a second parting in our long overdue but painful breakup. He didn't say a word. He took the key off the ring, he put it down on the table, and walked out. When the door closed, all I really felt was relief as I stared at the key. The news came as a surprise to my parents, for I had taken my grandmother's dictum, "Never speak poorly about your husband," to the extreme. "Why didn't you tell me how bad this was years ago?" my mother asked. "I thought if I ever forgave him, you might not," I answered dutifully. "Puddin's rule didn't apply to me," she said. "I had no idea you were so miserable. You should have left long ago." She later confessed to me that the night before my wedding, she and my father had hoped I would call it off. I was relieved to have their support, but not surprisingly, not everyone in my family felt the same. I took Puddin' for a walk around her block to break the news, and instead of her support, I received a rare, strong rebuke. You made your bed, you have to sleep in it. It was the only time I